This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Good to be with you.
The threat from Russia over Ukraine is exposing just how militarily weak Europe is. Efforts to boost defense spending, to strengthen armies, and to unify militarily have always been slow, and they've encountered many obstacles. These recent events have some leaders insisting it is past time for much more robust action. The most notable of these is the leader of Europe, Germany. For this story, we'll go to Richard.
Yes, the German Council of Foreign Relations, just over a week ago, they put out an article or a write-up by their president, Dr. Thomas Enders. He's a former Airbus CEO. He's also, he's been pretty close to the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, or the former Chancellor. He's traveled, accompanied her on a lot of overseas visits. He is part of Germany's leading classes, I guess you could say. And he put out an article saying that Germany needs to make some pretty dramatic military changes in response to what's happening in Russia. I think one thing that really stood out to me is he said that Germany should start spending between 2-3% of its economy on its military, which it sounds kind of, when you talk about percentage, it sounds kind of dry and statistical. 2-3% spending is huge for Germany. People have tried to push Germany for years to spend 2%. On their military. And now he's saying 2% is the bare minimum. You know, maybe it should be closer to 3%. And what he's really calling for there behind those dry numbers is quite the revolution. So he's calling, a Germany that's spending 3% is a Germany that's spending dramatically more than Russia. You know, if we use today's figures, that would be Germany spending around $120 billion on its defense, compared to $70 billion from Russia. It would be spending twice the UK. It would be spending more than twice of what France spends. And you look at what Vladimir Putin is able to do with his military budget, where you have a strong leader and he can make the world tremble, and he can have the entire world sitting on the edge of their seats going, is he going to invade in Ukraine or isn't he? And Germany is looking at, or he's trying to push Germany to spend dramatically more than that. This would make Germany absolutely the military leader of Europe and a major military power in the world. Beyond that, he also talked about the need to do more together as a European Union. He talked about a European defense union, getting together with France and forming this this European defense union. He talked about creating a European nuclear deterrent based on France's nuclear weapons. Major steps towards a super state. So Germany itself would be spending more, and then Europe would be working much more closely together. I mean, this is the kind of the recipe for a European superpower that he's putting forwards. And again, this is not just, this is coming from a think tank. Okay, he does not have the power to wake up tomorrow morning and say, this is going to happen, I'm going to make it happen. But at the same time, it's not just your average Joe Blow spouting off what he thinks should come next for Europe. The particular think tank, the German Council of Foreign Relations, this is a German government-funded think tank. They get about a quarter of their funding directly from the German government. These think tanks, these really are almost a tool of German public policy. This is how they conduct their, or this is how they come up with policies. It goes through these think tanks. They make concrete recommendations. They get picked up by the government. So this is quite a credible discussion as well.
And maybe you could just talk about how this is happening in the context of a general sense within European nations that it is time to step up militarily.
I mean, we've had a general sense within European nations for several years. I mean, we talked about this in the wake of Afghanistan, for example,
right,
several months ago, this sense. It's not just a sense, it's action. It's Poland last October announcing that they're going to double the number of personnel that they have inside their armed forces. You know, that's a huge increase. You're looking at Greece increasing their military budget 60% compared to what it was in 2019. It's Italy struggling to avoid bankruptcy, yet every single year since 2017, their military budget goes up and in quite substantial terms. I think it's about $2 billion up compared to where it was in 2017. And then there's some of these more, or you've got Sweden, as you mentioned, boosting their defense by 50%. We've got another article that just went up on the website that's just talking about a study that's come out from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute that covers an even broader range of different militaries and talking about how military spending across the board, but especially in Europe, is increasing. And then you do have, it's early days after the Ukraine response. I think European leaders are more kind of scrambling for how do we deal with what's happening than how do we make long-term changes right now. But already you do see that kind of change in response. You see Sweden kind of scrambling forces, getting them to this island Gotland in the Baltic Sea in case that there's some kind of Russian play for that particular island. You see this in Germany's response. I think you see signs already that one of the big takeaways from this whole Ukraine crisis is, okay, Europe needs to do more. And especially because the United States' response has been relatively ineffective. I know Mr. Biden's sending troops to the region, but they've also made it quite clear that they're not really prepared to defend Ukraine or anything like that. It's the whole situation here is that, well, NATO isn't really functioning. That's going to make a lot of individual countries think, well, we need to look more to ourselves, our own resources, and we need to spend more.
Yeah, absolutely. To put this in the context of America's withdrawal from Europe and the what looks like really the demise of NATO that is happening right before our eyes, you can see just how much more urgent this would be. Now, anyone who's been reading and listening to what the Trumpet has been putting out for years and years knows that we are very focused on all developments related to expansion and unification of Europe's military capabilities. But this really has been kind of a story of a lot of talk and not a lot of action. Maybe you can just contextualize this in light of what has happened in the past. How is it, do you feel like, are we hitting a point that is really different now as these things are coming together? You mentioned several active measures that European nations are taking, but especially why this is important from a standpoint of biblical prophecy, that European military development really is something that we must be vigilant to watch for.
Right. Well, we turned a corner, I think, with Europe's military, and we turned a corner several years ago now, where for years and years after the Cold War, it was cutting defense budgets after cutting defense budgets. And the only conversation is, how much shall we cut by? How much is safe to cut by? Is that too big of a cut? There has been concrete change along these lines, just in terms of that direction has shifted now. And we're raising defense budgets. And the discussion is now, how much should we raise them by? But at the same time, some of these things, like a European military, they are hard to do. And we've been forecasting that this is going to happen based on Bible prophecy. Like you said, this is a forecast that goes all the way back to decades and decades. The book of Revelation 17, we come back to here again and again, because it so clearly describes this power, this beast power, as it's called, but this empire that rises and falls, that rises and goes underground. And so as this empire was falling in 1945, as this empire was going underground or into the bottomless pit, to use the vocabulary of that particular chapter, Herbert W. Armstrong was there saying it's going to rise again. And he said it's going to rise again as a military power, then a political power, then a military power. And one of the things I find so fascinating about his forecast is he also went on to say over the years, well, it's not going to be an easy process. It's not going to be simple and straightforward. And it hasn't been. It to get one European country to trust their armed forces for another, for France and Italy that have for France and Germany that have a history going back, I don't know, 1,000 years or so of fighting each other, for France to say, okay, yeah, we'll merge our military and we'll trust Germany to defend us, that's a big step. And so one of the things Mr. Armstrong said is, well, it's going to take some kind of a crisis to bring this together. It's going to take a strong leader. It's going to take the involvement of the Catholic Church. And the Bible talks about all of these different elements. And you can certainly see in Russia the potential to help cause this real sense of crisis. You know, the corner has been turned. Things have changed in Europe. But you're seeing this sense of crisis build of, okay, well, we do need to take some more extreme action, some action that maybe we've been unwilling to undertake so far, like this kind of European military. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has really focused on this kind of right from the start of Russia's aggression as well, going all the way back to his kind of landmark 2008 article where Russia invaded Georgia. And he produced this article on what it means and where it's going from here. And that article has been the last, 13, 14 years of Russian policy. It has really proven very accurate. You know, the way he identified that Russia is going to try and recreate the Soviet Union, bring all of these countries in. But one of the key things he focused on was Europe's response, that it's going to provide Europe this fear and this impetus to unite. And for someone like Germany, where they are working with Russia to a certain extent, they're working with Russia to help push the United States out, to kind of help bring down NATO. But at the same time, by building up this fear of Russia, they create this need for a high military spending, this need for a European military, which if then Germany's spending 2 or 3%, and if they're spending double what France is, they're going to absolutely dominate that European military. So by fueling this rise of Russia, they're also just fueling this appetite for a German-led military union in Europe. So that's absolutely the way events are trending right now, and that's absolutely what the Bible said would happen.
Where would you send people for more information on this, Richard?
So I have an article up this week, Will the Ukraine Crisis Militarize Europe, that goes over, you know, some of what we've talked about in the most immediate. And then we also just had an article from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry this week, Why Germany Just Betrayed America, that just gives a great overview of this relationship between Germany and Russia, the history of that relationship, and what the Bible says is coming here, and how it affects the United States as well. There's a lot in there about how dangerous what's happening in Europe is for America, and that's something that you need to understand too.
It's fascinating to see how these events really are driving a number of prophecies forward. We'll just continue to watch to see how this develops in light of what we understand from Bible prophecy. Thank you for that, Richard. As the world's attention focuses on Ukraine, ministers of European Parliament are saying Russia has already effectively occupied Belarus. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this was in a letter published on Tuesday from 77 members of European Parliament. And it makes, I think, a very compelling case that, just as you said there, while the eyes of the world have been glued on Ukraine and on everything that Vladimir Putin's Russia is doing there, Putin has taken the opportunity to basically complete his occupation of the former Soviet nation of Belarus. So Belarus, of course, has been closely aligned with Russia ever since the Soviet Union collapsed back at the start of the 90s. Russia has kept Belarus tightly in its orbit since then, and they've even been working on a plan to merge Belarus officially into Russia and form a union state between the two. But now it looks like Putin is focusing on a different strategy to bring Belarus fully under his control. We've spoken on several recent episodes about the more than 100,000 Russian troops that Putin has deployed around Ukraine right now, possibly in preparation for an invasion. And we've talked about how a great many of those are actually in Belarus, just north of the Ukraine-Belarus border. There are at least 30,000 Russian soldiers now in Belarus. So these MEPs, they're essentially saying that what if that was Putin's goal all along, or at least a major component of his goal. You know, whether he invades Ukraine or not, he now has 30,000 highly capable, combat-ready Russian troops inside of Belarus. And the MEPs who wrote this letter say that just having that many forces there means this already equates to a de facto Russian occupation of Belarus. And they say that it's happening with the full authorization of Belarus's longtime dictator as well, Alexander Lukashenko. One short part of their letter, it says, "The recent deployment of Russian troops in Belarus poses a threat to Ukraine, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, and the whole of Europe. The continued presence of Russian military forces at the request of the illegitimate Lukashenko regime should be treated as an occupation of Belarus. So that was it was signed by 77 MEPs. They're from over a dozen European nations, and they're just very concerned about what Putin has apparently already accomplished in Belarus and what his plans may be from here.
The occupation of Belarus is problematic and concerning in and of itself, but geographically, there's a reason why Ukrainians are particularly concerned about what Putin is doing in Belarus.
That's right. Yeah, that's a very worrying part of this. These MEPs that we've been talking about, they're worried that the Russian troops inside of southern Belarus may never leave Belarus. But the Ukrainians, by contrast, they're worried that these forces will leave Belarus in order to invade Ukraine's capital city, Kiev. So the location in the south of Belarus where the bulk of these Russian soldiers are, it's only about 85 miles from Kiev. It's the closest route to Kiev from anywhere outside of Ukraine. So as we've stressed on several recent episodes, it's impossible to know for sure what Putin plans to do. You know, it's like the famous Churchill quote when he was asked what Russia will do next back in the 1930s. He said, "I can't tell you because Russia is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma." You know, some classic Churchillian poetry there, but it's also very insightful. And Russia remains every bit as enigmatic today as it was then. We don't know exactly what will happen, whether it's a de facto occupation of Belarus or an invasion of Kiev or maybe some sort of combination. But whatever the case is, this is just a highly combustible situation.
Where would you send people to understand the prophetic relevance of what's happening?
We have a booklet from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And if any listeners would like to understand the developments in Eastern Europe in the prophetic context, I would just recommend that they read that booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
All right. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. We have followed the escalating threat from Yemen's Houthi fighters against the United Arab Emirates. This week, the United States sent some military support to help the situation. To learn about this, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, ever since January 17, the attacks on the United Arab Emirates emanating from Yemen by the Houthis have really dramatically increased, and it is like a sign of something very new that's happening. And in response to these, the United States has said it is going to send some fighter jets as well as a guided missile destroyer to try and help the United Arab Emirates counter the escalating threat. That's what the Wall Street Journal wrote just yesterday. And the French are also sending some fighter jets down there and also going to help with the missile defensive systems that the UAE uses. And so I don't necessarily think it's huge news that the United States is deciding to send at least a show of force to support the UAE. Whether that has any type of restraining force on the Houthis, we'll see. But it is kind of really interesting to look at these attacks that are taking place. And these are major ballistic missile attacks, drone attacks that are targeting the critical UAE infrastructure, the capital. Abu Dhabi has been under attack numerous times. It was under attack just this Wednesday as well. This time the attack actually just was three drones that came into its airspace that actually came from Iraq rather than the Houthis. But every week or every few days now, it seems, is a ballistic missile attack or a drone attack on the UAE, mostly from the Houthis, but even a Shiite-backed militia from Iraq is joining in on this. And this is really a dramatic escalation of warfare. The Iranians, these are Iranian-backed groups that are doing this. They haven't really targeted the UAE too much in the past. There was one big attack in 2018, but that was a one-off. But now they're coming every second or third day, and allies of the UAE are getting a little bit, I think, concerned by this and trying to do what they can to at least suppress it.
You said that you're not particularly surprised that the United States would have a show of force in this situation. Maybe you can just explain your view of America's role in what's taking place here relative to everything else that it's been doing in the Middle East.
Right. The Houthis were really somebody that the Biden administration took great notice of, and also the war in Yemen immediately, day one, first foreign policy decision of the Biden administration is to take away the terrorist designation that Donald Trump put on the Houthis, an Iranian-backed group that regularly terrorizes Saudi Arabia, international shipping, and now the UAE. The United States also withdrew their support for the UAE and Saudi Arabia in the war against the Houthis. And then fast forward, here we are, not too long, a year later, and what do we see but an absolutely emboldened Houthis to go about these attacks. Now, the United States always does this in terms of the Biden administration, Obama administration. They make it seem like they are befriending their allies by and supporting their allies by even arms sales, perhaps, or even a show of force, meaning sending some of their fighters into the area. But does anyone think that the United States is going to go and start attacking the launch sites of the Houthis, if of these ballistic missiles? That's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. You saw the same thing with Obama and Israel. Of course, this is the most anti-Israel president that Israel has ever seen. And what did he do? He signed a massive $4.3 billion arms agreement with, I think it's 4.3, I'm just going from memory here, it might be more than that, billion dollars of arms agreement with Israel at the very same time that it emboldens and strengthens the adversaries of the state of Israel, being the Iranians. And so that's no surprises here that the Biden administration is deciding to send some fighters into the region. I think it's more significant that the French are jumping in as well, saying, yeah, we're going to be a part of this. We're sending our fighters. In terms of biblical prophecy, we know that the UAE, as part of this Psalm 83 alliance that is going to be allied with European nations, and France will be a part of that. Mm. We know that they're going to be looking to Europe for support against the Iranians and the Iranian proxies such as the Houthis. The United States has done nothing but embolden the Iranian proxies as well as Iran. That was a huge favor for the Iranians on day one, and to stop the Houthis being a terrorist designate by the United States, and to pull out of the Yemen war. The Iranians wanted that. They needed that. And now what the United States is doing is having a show of support, but no real skin in the game from the United States right here in support of the UAE. The UAE is just going to cop the brunt of it.
So I suppose the real significance of this will play out in the weeks ahead.
Yeah, I think so. I think we'll see, unless the UAE reverses course and decides to slow down its attacks in Yemen against the Houthis. That's the reason this is happening, is because the UAE has been very successful at battling Iran's proxy in Yemen, and Iran doesn't like it. And so what Iran is saying is, Houthis, you start firing ballistic missiles, drones, our Shiite militias in Iraq, you start firing on the UAE, you hit their capital, you make them suffer. You make the United States, as they did this week, come out with a statement saying U.S. citizens don't travel to the UAE. It's too dangerous. That's how the UAE functions, not just on, I think it's gas exports. It's also functions a lot on tourism, massive tourism. Sure. Hub through that's two major airports. Yeah. And if Iran can jeopardize that, then the UAE thinks twice about what they're doing inside Yemen. This is a regional war that's going on. It might not be that obvious, but the big players are Iran and its proxies and the Gulf states and their allies that you thought would be the United States, but really the European nations are going to come in and support them. If people want to know more about this, they can read our trend article, An Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe.
All right. Thank you for that, Brent. We will link to that trend article in the show notes, and we'll keep our eye on events as they unfold there in the UAE. Back to a story about China and how it has deeply compromised America's president. For this, we will turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, as the protests against vaccine mandates continue in Canada, more and more people across both the United States and Canada are waking up to the fact that their leaders are acting like communist dictators for a very relevant reason. Just this week, a new book hit the number one spot on the New York Times bestsellers list. Its author is Peter Schweizer, and the book is titled Red-Handed: How American Elites Get Rich Helping China Win. And the main thrust of the book is mostly focused on Joe Biden and his family and other American elites who've basically sold their nation up the river in return for lucrative business deals with China. We've talked on this program many times before about Hunter Biden and his role in selling 44% of the world's cobalt, previously owned by an American company, to the Chinese, his role in helping China take over the Australian coal industry, and even selling out auto parts makers here in the United States. They're making products with military applications to the Chinese. And Mr. Schweizer, he covers all that in his book. But he also covers another angle, doesn't spend as much time on it, but a particularly relevant angle in light of the Freedom Convoy in Ottawa, Canada right now, about just how compromised the Trudeau administration is by Red China as well. The book starts back in the 1960s when Justin Trudeau's father, Pierre Trudeau, was actually Prime Minister of Canada. And his role in opening Canada for business in China, and even his trip to China to meet Mao Zedong, and his book, he wrote a book when he getting back that really praising communist China, and then but bringing that this wasn't just a one off thing, but going all the way up through Justin Trudeau and some of his business deals with the Chinese National Offshore Oil Corporation. Talking about Justin's brother, Alexander Trudeau, who recently published a book entitled Barbarians Lost: Travels in the New China, which compares the West, America and Canada, very unfavorably to China. And so now you've got truckers up there in Canada accusing Justin Trudeau of being a tyrant when they really should be remembering that even just in 2013, only about 9 years ago, at a fundraiser, Justin Trudeau actually said that there's a level of admiration I actually have for China. Their basic dictatorship is actually allowing them to turn their economy around on a dime and to say we need to go green and we need to start investing in solar. And so just bringing up the point that like a lot of these environmental response that the left's doing here in North America is they're actually really envious of this dictatorial power that Chinese leaders have. So there's this ideological alignment that people like Joe Biden and Justin Trudeau have with how the Chinese leaders operate, in addition to these deep financial ties that they keep making with these Chinese corporations. And so anyone wondering why we're patterning our coronavirus lockdowns after the draconian lockdowns you've seen in Beijing and other cities across China should really remember this. Maybe even read that book, Red-Handed: How China's Elites Get Rich Helping America Win, to see some of these just really disturbing connections behind that.
Yeah, there have been a number of times where Western leaders have made these disturbing statements of their admiration for the authoritarian capabilities of these Chinese leaders. But beyond that, I'm just reminded of that statement by that Chinese professor, a high member of the Chinese Communist Party, who basically said for years, and really until Donald Trump, we had our friends in high places in America, and we were able to make sure that their policies were favorable to our aims, trade-wise, and they stayed out of our way basically because he was implying that they were beholden to Chinese interests through exactly these kinds of deals that this author has spelled out in this book. How much is this influencing American policy, Canadian policy toward China? How much has this kind of corruption actually enabled China to accomplish what it is?
Right. I mean, one of the articles we'll put in the show notes is it's about a year old now, almost a year old next month, actually this month, entitled Wake Up to the Threat from China, that does go through even some comments by a Chinese dissident saying that the Chinese party, I mean, this is not just a coincidence that this has worked out for them, but they've strategized a way to really become the dominant power in the world by taking over natural resources in places like the U.S. and Canada, and said that a big part of that is just the money interest, is like basically get American elites, corrupt them, or weaponize their corruption and desire for money to enrich themselves in the short term by selling out strategic assets to Chinese. I mean, this cobalt deal that Hunter Biden did is a prime example of that. And then this book brings out several things Justin Trudeau has done with the oil industry as well. I mean, and it does just really highlight the fact that, like, personal morality is so intrinsically tied to national security. When you've got a class of leaders that's more loyal to their own business interests than they are to the long-term well-being and national security of your country, I mean, that's a huge problem. It's basically treason from within. That article even brings out some verses in Isaiah, bringing out how just drawing the parallels between where Isaiah was condemning the leaders of ancient Israel, saying that you've turned away from God, you're replenished from the East, talking about them following after financial ties and more importantly false religion from countries east of Israel, and China's definitely east of modern day Israel, far east of modern day Israel. And you can really see that kind of the same thing, where you've got this elite class that's really more interested in going after Eastern philosophies like communism and financial ties with foreign nations than they are encouraging their own people to get back to biblical religion and making financial decisions that, even if it hurts their bottom line a little bit in the short term, ensures the long-term survival of the nation they live in.
Mm. Well, we do appreciate you bringing that to us. We will link to that article, Wake Up to the Threat from China. We also have an article, Communism in America Today, that details some of the influence that China has created ideologically within the United States. We thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, China has the eyes of the world upon it as it kicks off the Winter Olympics, a military coup in Mali that is complicating relations with European nations, the Biden administration designating Qatar a major non-NATO ally, and America's national debt blasting past $30 trillion. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The Winter Olympics are beginning, this picture of cooperation and friendly competition among nations. And there's an interesting, dramatic geopolitical dimension this year, as they're being hosted by China, a dictatorship ruled by a man who plans to rule for life. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Winter Games have just started in Beijing today, and I think with the eyes of the world on China, it is a good chance for us to just turn our attention to its leader, Xi Jinping, and to be reminded of just how powerful this man has become and how dangerous his rule is. So this is it's actually the second set of Olympic Games that Xi Jinping is overseeing. His first round back in 2008 happened when Xi was not yet president. He was just a virtually unknown politician at that time. But he became secretary general of the Communist Party a couple of years after that. And then he took the ceremonial title of president in 2013. And in the years since then, Xi Jinping has just fully embraced a strongman approach to leading China. He crushed pro-democracy groups and virtually all other activists. He took direct control of writing policy on everything from China's economy and international relations to its internet regulations. He also waged a now famous anti-corruption campaign that resulted in either the arrest or imprisonment of about 1.4 million Communist Party members. So just a stunning number there. And he has disappeared thousands of dissidents. He also, of course, imprisoned well over 1 million of China's Uyghur Muslims in some of the most just nightmarish camps you can imagine. And he's also forced many of China's private sector's successes to divert billions of dollars into national coffers. And then Xi also implemented profound military reforms that made him the unchallenged head of China's vast and very powerful army. And then, of course, on top of all of that, he removed those constitutional limits so that he's going to be able to remain head of China basically for as long as he lives. So Xi Jinping is now China's strongest and most ruthless leader since Mao Zedong. And thanks to him, the China that we see hosting the Olympics right now is starkly different from the China that hosted back in 2008. It's far more authoritarian, far more ruthless, and far more powerful than it was then.
With these Olympic Games, you hear some Western nations are voicing their displeasure over China for this or that and what Xi Jinping is doing. How effective is the opposition to what's happening there? And it almost seems like maybe a bit of a microcosm of what's happening geopolitically with China. The opposition just doesn't seem to be able to do much to prevent him from having his way.
Yeah, that's true. It is getting more and more difficult for world leaders to ignore Xi Jinping's twisted leadership, as hard as some of them may try to. And his human rights abuses, especially his genocide of those Uyghur Muslims, it has prompted many nations to diplomatically boycott the games this year. So the U.S., for example, didn't send its usual roster of high-profile dignitaries. Usually that's led by the First Lady. Britain and Australia and Japan and Denmark and a handful of others are following the U.S.'s lead. And that is a significant snub to Xi Jinping because he wants events like this to further strengthen him in the eyes of his own people. He also wants it to just showcase his power to the rest of the world. So it's a significant snub, but Vladimir Putin has really come through for Xi Jinping. While American leaders and all those others are staying away, Putin is right there in Beijing. It's actually the first time Putin and Xi have met in person since 2019, before the pandemic started. So quite notable for that reason on its own. But the way that Putin is helping Xi just to better legitimize himself and to paint himself as a widely admired leader, that's, I think, every bit as significant. And it's going a long way toward further strengthening the Russia-China alliance.
We don't necessarily think of Olympic Games as being prophetically significant, but it's hard not to put this in the context of everything that we're seeing coming from China, and it really does fulfill a very important biblical prophecy, what we're seeing.
Yeah, it does. In the modern age, Xi Jinping's immense and virtually unchecked powers seem a little bit anomalous, but history is filled with dictators like him. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that based on prophecy, we should expect these kinds of authoritarian governments and policies to soon be dominating the world. He wrote an article for our February 2020 issue. It's called The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man. And it's all about a prophecy saying that in the end time, the world would go from having the United States and the UK as the main global powers to a new era that the Bible calls the times of the Gentiles. And this will be a time when China becomes one of the main global powers. One part of this article says, "These times of the Gentiles are yet to be fully realized. However, we are in the outer edges of this catastrophic storm. China's actions prove that Gentiles are rising to power before our eyes." And then skipping down a little, it says, "This is the ghastly culmination of 6,000 years of man's rule over man. This is the nightmare awaiting mankind just ahead." So, you know, the games, being able to host these and have the eyes of the world on you, this is a part of it. This shows that China is rising despite how perverse Xi Jinping's leadership is. So it's really sobering, I think, to see the darkness in China today and to see how twisted that leadership is. But it's even more sobering to know that this is just a preview of how dark the whole world is on its way to becoming.
We thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. We will link to that article in the show notes. Germany's key base in North Africa, Mali, had a military coup some time ago, and it is complicating relations with European nations. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so Mali had a coup back in, I think, May of 2021. They're now a military dictatorship. And France recently criticized the military rulers, saying that they were out of control and illegitimate. That got France sent packing and kicked out of Mali. Denmark has announced that they're going to pull out of the country. And this is quite a big deal for Germany because Mali is a key plank in Germany's whole strategy of confronting radical Islam in North Africa. They've got a huge military mission over there. There's a European Union mission. There's a United Nations mission. And Germany's got authorization for over 1,000 troops to be deployed in Mali. It's I think, certainly their biggest deployment outside of Europe, maybe even their biggest deployment outside of Germany. So it's a big deal for them, and they've got senior generals that have talked about how for them Mali is a potential staging ground, so that they've got a strong military presence and they can use that to try and combat radical Islam all across North Africa. And now there's question marks. There's basically Germany starting to be confronted with a decision as to whether they completely withdraw from Mali or double down. And double down will have to mean more troops. It might even mean overthrowing the military rule or being more involved in government. But whatever it is, they're going to, if they want to stay there, they'll have to step it up. Now, this is very much an ongoing story, and I don't know how it ends, but it is a story that's very important to keep watching. Trumpet editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury, he had an article all the way back in April 2013. And in that article, it begins, the article's called Watch Algeria, another country in that region. He says, North Africa is turning into a battleground with enormously important prophetic implications. And he talked about how you're getting radical Islam sponsored by and pushed by Iran spreading throughout the region. And he says, Iran isn't the only one interested in Africa. Germany is making strong inroads as well. Both of these powers are racing to get as much control of North Africa as they can. They will inevitably clash with each other. And there's the potential to kind of watch this kind of thing unfold, potentially in real time, in Mali there. So he goes into more of the prophecy in that article. Daniel chapter 11 talks about this clash between a king of the north and a king of the south, between Germany and radical Islam led by Iran. That chapter talks about Egypt, talks about Libya being involved in this clash. North Africa was a major theater for this clash, and we're watching some of the maneuverings around this clash unfolding right now.
Well, we will do as you say and keep our eyes on that situation. In the meantime, we'll link to that Gerald Fleury article, Watch Algeria, for understanding of the prophetic ramifications of that situation in North Africa. Thank you, Richard. President Biden named Qatar as a major non-NATO ally of the U.S. Why did he do that, and what does this mean? For answers, we'll go back to Brenton Octagall.
On Monday, the leader of Qatar was in the White House meeting with President Biden, and just before that meeting, there was an announcement that was given to the press that President Biden intends to make Qatar a major non-NATO ally. And he said this reflects the importance of our relationship. Quote, I think it's long overdue. And this is an important Gulf state. I think it's one that we might overlook and just think it acts in the same way as the UAE or Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or Kuwait. But really, this is an interesting dynamic, very rich, very wealthy Arab state. I think per capita, it's probably the richest nation or close to it in the world, definitely in the Gulf. And it's one that the Biden administration and Obama administration have been very close to. Of course, Qatar's relationship with the Biden administration was very obvious when the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan. This was the staging point for most of the evacuees. 70,000 Afghani refugees came through Qatar on their way through to the United States, where they are today. And the United States is really looking to Qatar to strengthen this relationship with them. I should say the Biden administration. I think for a number of reasons, this article from the New York Times and all the other reporting is basically saying that this is a way for greater security cooperation investment in the Gulf nation at a time when Mr. Biden is seeking to help boost natural gas supplies in Europe. So they're linking it to what's going on with Ukraine and Russia and saying he just needs to be close to them to give the Europeans another option for gas supplies. But there's nothing about the gas supplies. There's nothing about Ukraine in any of the readouts, the official documents. That's the kind of the press and how they're handling it. And the Biden administration is probably happy about that. But this is a nation that the United States, Biden administration, Obama administration wants to be close to. This is not a nation that's on the same side as Saudi Arabia or the Emiratis. These states are kind of, they're not at war with each other, but there is a cold war going on between them. This is a nation that funds actively the Muslim Brotherhood. This is a nation that houses Ismail Haniyeh, the leader of Hamas, the leader, one of the religious jurists of the Muslim Brotherhoods inside Qatar right now as well. And it's really a nation that funds a lot of the left-wing think tanks inside the United States, such as Brookings, as well as a lot of the higher education gets massive funding from Qatar. So it's got extreme ties with the deep state as well in the United States. And so what we're seeing here is the Biden administration elevating Qatar, the home base, or one of the home bases of the Muslim Brotherhood, to a real close strategic partner, kind of almost as close as you can get to the United States without being part of Five Eyes or NATO.
This designation, major non-NATO ally, what other nations have this designation for the United States, and what sort of benefits does this give Qatar?
There are currently 17 countries that are granted this status. They include Australia, Egypt, Israel, Japan, South Korea, Jordan, New Zealand, Thailand, nations like that. And though Saudi Arabia is not on the list, the UAE is not on the list, these are our traditional allies. The United States is traditional allies. President Donald Trump conferred the status on Brazil in 2019. Again, not a Muslim Brotherhood supporter nation. What it does is it gives, according to the New York Times, and I haven't looked up this up in too much detail before the show, but they write that the designation gives Qatar more diplomatic prestige and access to technology, security systems, and training by U.S. defense forces that had not been previously available to it. And so that's kind of the scary part, because you're seeing an activation of U.S. security personnel and know-how and technology that could be opened up to being shared with Qatar through this arrangement. And again, this is not how it's being sold, but that's the reality of what happens when you give such a designation. And I think Americans should worry. I think anyone that's followed the deep state in the United States would be very aware of this. Brennan's got great big ties to Qatar. Most of the echo chamber from the nuclear deal was put out by think tanks funded by Qatar. The Qataris are kind of like, in terms of biblical prophecy, we really look at the king of the south, led by radical Islam, led by Iran, as being the dominant force. But the Qataris are kind of the Muslim Brotherhood side of it, that eventually, it seems, the Muslim Brotherhood, and based in Egypt also, is going to align with Iran as well. And right now, Qatar does play that middle of the road nation. They're not in on side with the Gulf, other Gulf states. They're closer to the Iranians, really supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think we see this as another play by the Biden-Obama administration to strengthen radical Islam. And yes, Iran would be the obvious choice, but strengthening Qatar also could have will have a similar effect. If people want to know about why the United States government, this United States government, would seek to do that, I think Mr. Gerald Flurry's article, The Barack Obama Mystery, would be worth reading.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Brent. One final story. America's ballooning national debt just broke a staggering new record. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, on Tuesday, the national debt officially hit $30 trillion, hitting an all-time record for the United States or any other nation in human history, increasing at just a shocking rate. I mean, it was only about $10 trillion when George W. Bush left office in 2008. So it's tripled in just the past 14, 15 years. And going up even faster than it was now than it was at the beginning of that 14, 15 year period, which is definitely leading many people to wonder how much debt can a nation take on before it collapses. There's a few people in America like Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez still maintaining that it doesn't matter how much debt America takes on, though I believe most people have a feeling that eventually this is going to catch up with us and it's going to be bad. But it's just not something they want to think about, something they're hoping is going to be in the far future. Now, I'll quote back when America was first founded, 1790, one of our founding fathers, Thomas Paine, gave us this warning that the burden of a national debt consists not in its being so many millions or so many hundreds of millions, but in the quantity of taxes collected each year to pay the interest. And so that quote tells us a couple interesting things. First of all, that the founding fathers were concerned about the national debt hitting 100 million. And second, that, I mean, the really serious thing we have to be looking at is like, well, how much of our budget are we going to have to allot each year to paying the interest on that? And right now, we paid $562 billion in interest on the national debt last year. So you do the math, that's about 13% of tax revenue. If you were to divide that by every person in America, that's about $1,500 per person that we paid last year on the national debt. So tax season's on us now. So you're filing your tax returns. You can just keep that in mind, that the first $1,500 in taxes you're paying is going to national debt, not to buy anything, but to actually just pay the interest on what we've already borrowed.
Mm.
And so that figure, I mean, we're obviously managing it. I mean, there's some problems like inflation and stuff that people would rather not deal with. But the huge thing is that this number, I mean, it's going to keep going up until America starts balancing its budgets. And it may go up much faster than you think if the interest rates go up. Right now, like the de facto interest rate on the national debt is about 1.75%. But the Congressional Budget Office predicts that that's going to triple in the next 30 years. And it may go up faster than they think, which means that within probably just 2 years, America is going to be spending more in interest on its debt than it is on its military. And within the next 2-3 decades, even at current interest rate projections, national debt is quickly going to become the biggest budget item, consuming, according to the Peterson Foundation, probably about half of all tax revenues by 2050. And so this is obviously a huge financial crisis. I mean, leading the country to bankruptcy. But beyond just that, it's also a huge moral crisis. I think Nathaniel Blake at The Federalist about a year or two back wrote an article where he stated this pretty well, where he said, federal deficit spending is not like going into personal debt. It's like a grandma going on a binge with her grandchildren's credit cards. It's parents signing away their children's future for some government handouts now. It's wrong to place our grandchildren under enormous debt. Just bringing up the very relevant point that a lot of people be like, well, we need this much spending for, you know, coronavirus stimulus and welfare packages and Social Security. But it's like, okay, well, like, I don't know, Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, maybe they won't live long enough to see the effects of these bills, these spending bills they're passing. But like their children and grandchildren are going to live in a nation where, like I said, 50% of all the taxes they collect are just going to payments on the debt. And then the other 50% is going to be for things like defense and roads. I mean, it's just you're going to be looking at pretty much all their income going straight to America's creditors, which is a burden no nation can sustain without bankruptcy. And so you're really robbing the country's future in order to get some votes in the midterm election or something by putting some pork in a bill to a particular constituency.
That's some tough truth to face. Andrew wrote an article about this. It went out in the Trumpet Brief last night. The Trumpet Brief, our daily email blast that gives some insights from some of our most senior writers at the Trumpet. We certainly encourage you to sign up for that. But the title of his article, U.S. National Debt Hits $30 Trillion, goes into some really important scriptures that describe just how dangerous going into debt is. There's a lot in the Bible about this and a lot of specific prophecy that shows just how catastrophic this is going to be for America in the time ahead. I really encourage you to read that article. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal, and thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Harry Truman. In reading the lives of great men, I found that the first victory they won was over themselves. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.